You are listening to the Monaco Daily First broadcast on the 12th of August 2022 on Monaco 24.
Sir Salman Rushdie attacked on stage in the United States. We'll have the latest. Eurovision shortens its list of the UK cities which might step in for Ukraine next year, and a reflection on Copenhagen Fashion Week. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monaco Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monaco Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and we'll be hearing from Monaco 24's Georgina Godwin, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Natalie Theodosi. Plus, we'll have Henry Rees Sheridan's latest letter from New York City. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monaco Daily. This is the Monaco Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. We will start today's show with news breaking in the last couple of hours. The British author Sir Salman Rushdie has been attacked on stage at a literary event in New York State. His condition is unclear as we go to air, but reports suggest that he was stabbed and received emergency treatment at the scene, after which he was airlifted to hospital. Rushdie, one of the most important and influential English language novelists of the modern era, was for much of the 1990s obliged to live under police protection after the government of Iran put a bounty on his head, having taken offence at Rushdie's 1988 novel The Satanic Verses, though it remains doubtful how many of the Ayatollahs or those who heeded their call to outrage ever troubled themselves to read it. I'm joined with more on this by Monaco 24 presenter and host of Monaco 24's Meet the Writers, Georgina Godwin. Georgina, just before we start, a very recent update from New York State Governor Kathy Hochul, who confirms at a press conference that Rushdie is alive and getting the care he needs, which I guess is about as good news as is possible in these circumstances. Beyond that, what do we actually know?
You know, very little. I mean, obviously it's profoundly shocking to everybody in the literary community and indeed all of his legion of readers. What we know is that shortly before 11 a.m. At the Chautauqua Institution, that's about 55 miles southwest of Buffalo in a rural corner of New York State, Rushdie was there to talk about the importance of the U.S. offering asylum for writers and other artists in exile. A man wearing a black mask jumped on the stage, stabbed him in the neck. He also injured his interlocutor not very badly. Rushdie was then, as you say, taken to hospital by medical helicopter. Now, as you alluded to, this goes back to the fatwa that was placed on him. This was for the 1988 book, his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses, and it led to accusations of blasphemy against Islam, lots of demonstrations across India and Pakistan by Islamic groups. Effectively, it was a sentence of death, an edict of death.
It did have fatal consequences for other people as well, translators, booksellers, etc.
Exactly. His Italian bookseller and his Italian translator and his Japanese translator were both murdered. I mean, as you say, the passionate international rage of Muslims towards the book surprised many Western readers because it wasn't published in Arabic, in Urdu, in Persian, in any of those languages. And it was never even published or sold in the countries where most Muslims lived. It was a work of fiction and frankly, quite a difficult book to read. So it was very surprising that this actually captured, you know, the attention of the people that took such umbrage.
Almost as if the Ayatollahs were whipping up some sort of persecution complex related controversy in complete bad faith.
Well, I mean, of course, the fatwa was reversed, though. Iran's government distanced itself from Khomeini's decree, but there's been anti-Rushdie sentiment lingering. In 2012, a semi-official Iranian religious foundation raised the bounty. Previously, it had been $2.8 million to $3.3 million, and that was still standing when this... it stands today. You know, he's always courted controversy as far back as his second novel, Midnight's Children.
Which is a perfectly reasonable thing for a novelist to do, of course.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, he actually said himself, let me find the quote. He said, "I spent my entire life as a writer in opposition and indeed conceived the writer's role as including the function of antagonist to the state." And that really is, I think, the role of writers.
Well, indeed so. He had always been, as you've alluded to, an advocate for free speech and free expression even before the fatwa, but the fatwa against him in 1988 made him more of one. It made him a test case and a touchstone for free speech, and he had become an absolutely passionate advocate for writers around the world.
Absolutely, and to that end, he did some work for English Pen, which is the organisation for which I'm a trustee, but he was also chair of Pen America, in fact, a role that my brother took over from him, and they are friends. I met Salman only once in Mexico at the Guadalajara Book Festival, and we chatted for not very long. Of course, he was there as absolutely the star of the festival, completely surrounded by people, and you know, it was almost impossible to get a few minutes with him. But I do remember in London and in New York, there were always these kind of whispers going around the kind of social scene. Salman might come tonight. And of course, you could never kind of pin it down and couldn't decide which party to go to because Salman would be there, because you didn't know if that was the one he'd be at.
I mean, I don't want to make this sound like we're improvising the poor fellow's obituary, because as far as we know, he is still with us and he is being treated, and we absolutely have to hope that he makes a swift and full recovery. But while we are talking about him, we should talk about, you know, the influence he has had, not just because of the controversy his work has attracted, but because of the work itself. You know, he's won one Booker Prize, I think two Booker of Bookers when they've handed those around.
Yep.
I mean, how is it possible to quantify his stature just as a purely literary figure?
Well, I mean, 14 novels, I think two travelogues, some anthologies of short stories, as you say, the Booker of Booker, which was a huge thing. I personally feel that his best book it's really his autobiography, which is called Joseph Anton. Now, that was a pseudonym that he used while he was in hiding following the fatwa, and he chose the name to honour the writers Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov. But the police officers that looked after him often didn't get it right, and they called him Joe, which apparently annoyed him. but it's a wonderful book. And it discusses his friendship with other writers like Bruce Chatwin, Paul Theroux, Bill Buford, Martin Amis, and so on. All of those big boys of British literature in the 80s. I mean, it was such a thriving scene at the time. And in fact, there's a previous Meet the Writers episode where I speak to John Walsh, who was the literary critic of the Sunday Times for many years. And he's just written this book, Circus of Dreams, in which he addresses this and addresses Salman and how everybody in London actually reacted to it at the time, which was honestly bemusement.
And not unreasonably, because I think it's probably the last thing you expect to occur when you write what is, as you say, quite a difficult literary novel. You're not necessarily expecting to become the most famous author on earth off the back of it. Yes. I'm glad you mentioned Joseph Anton, though, which is a fabulous book, and it contains, I think, a thing that got It certainly got overlooked at the time, and perhaps a bit less since now, you know, since he came out of seclusion and came out of police protection and began enjoying life again. But despite the subject matter, Joseph Anton is in many stretches a very, very funny book. And certainly in recent years, Rushdie has allowed himself to have a bit of fun with the idea of being Salman Rushdie, up to and including appearing in an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, making fun of the fatwa.
And to that end, that whole of being Salman Rushdie, the whole book is written in the third person rather than the first person, which is, I mean, very unusual for that kind of book. As you say, as almost as if he is kind of, you know, taking the mic.
We will, of course, be following that story over the weekend and returning to it in our shows during the week. But for now, Georgina Godwin, thank you very much. And for what it may be worth, best wishes to Salman Rushdie for a swift and complete recovery. Georgina Godwin, thank you. It is time now on the Monocle Daily for our weekly letter from New York City. And this week, Henry Rhys Sheridan looks at New York City's sewage problems and Donald Trump's legal problems.
According to Wikipedia, a cloaca is a posterior orifice that serves as the only opening for the digestive, reproductive, and urinary tracts of many vertebrate animals. All amphibians, reptiles, and birds have this orifice, as well as a few mammals. From their cloaca, they excrete both urine and feces. But what do cloaca have to do with New York? Well, they're the best analogy I can think of for the city's sewage system. Most of NYC has what's called a combined sewer system. This means there's only one pipe that carries both storm water runoff and sewage from buildings. Like the cloaca itself, this may seem like an elegant design solution to an age-old problem. A single passage through which all manner of excreta are sluiced. But there's a catch. Heavy rainfall can overwhelm New York sewage system, and this can force untreated sewage discharge and street rubbish into surrounding waterways. This seems to have happened during recent flash floods in the city, and the overspill is the most likely cause of high bacteria readings in some of the city's waters. Last week, bacteria was so abundant in the sea at Jacob Riis Beach that it was closed to bathers. And overflowing poo-poo and pee-pee aren't the only challenges faced by New York swimming spots this summer. Beaches and city pools have been partially or fully closed at various points due to shark sightings and a lifeguard shortage. With temperatures soaring, these disruptions are coming at a time when New Yorkers need their beaches the most. While the rest of the city has been struggling with solar and geophysical heat, former President Donald Trump was having heat of a different variety blasted in his face. Political and legal heat.
Biden administration, the Democrats are weaponizing the FBI, and it has to stop. The FBI is not here to weaponize against another president. It never has happened before.
Trump was in town this week to be questioned over allegations of financial fraud. The office of New York Attorney General Letitia James claims to have evidence that the Trump organization routinely inflated the value of its properties to claim tax breaks and favorable loan rates. It's one of several legal challenges Trump is facing. On Monday, the FBI searched Trump's Mar-a-Lago private resort home in Florida. The raid is reportedly part of an investigation into sensitive material that Mr. Trump took when he left the White House. However, no official explanation for the search has been given as of writing, and Trump's defenders are painting the move as a political attack against the former president.
I was shocked and surprised that the FBI would do that.
I think it's political because the midterms are coming. The midterms are coming.
I support Trump. I against the FBI. They do not have the government to overuse their right.
The usual suspects are weighing in on Trump's side, but there are also some unfamiliar faces in the crowd questioning the wisdom of the search. The day after the search, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo tweeted that the Department of Justice must immediately explain the reason for its raid, or it will undermine any future credible investigation and the legitimacy of the January 6th investigations. In office, Andrew Cuomo was a critic and rival of Trump's. So why is he feeling the need to weigh in here? It might be on principle, it might be a matter of political strategy. But Cuomo may also be feeling a wave of involuntary empathy for Trump. This week marks the anniversary of Cuomo's resignation as governor. Cuomo resigned in light of a report detailing his sexual harassment of 11 women while in office. That investigation was overseen by Letitia James, the same New York Attorney General investigating Trump's real estate practices. Even though the allegations against Cuomo have been verified by independent investigators, Cuomo has challenged the Attorney General's report and worked to reframe it as a political attack against him. So it isn't beyond the realm of possibility that Cuomo has a heightened sensitivity to alleged political attacks by the justice system against politicians, even when the allegations are coming from an old political enemy.
That was Henry Rhys Sheridan in New York City, plays all his own banjo. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. We have known for a few weeks now that the UK will step in for Ukraine to host next year's Eurovision Song Contest. We now have a slightly clearer idea of where in the UK the pan-continental warbling tournament might occur. Seven British cities have made the shortlist from which the lucky winner will be chosen, and they are, in unbiased alphabetical order, Birmingham, Glasgow, Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle and Sheffield. Better luck next time, Luton. Joining me now to determine once and for all who should get it and to whom all subsequent complaints about any conclusions reached by this item should be directed are Monocle 24's Eurovision Desk Chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Monocle 24's Assistant Deputy Eurovision Desk Chief, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Thank you both for joining us. Two of Monocle 24's vast Eurovision staff taking time out from their busy, round-the-clock, full-time work, keeping up to date with all that's going on with Eurovision to discuss next week's venue. Fernando, of those seven cities, who should get it?
Well, that's the question, right?
That is literally the question, Fernando, which I just asked.
You know what? I tend to go with my heart, and I think my heart is saying Newcastle for a reason.
Newcastle. Why do you hate, Fernando, Birmingham, Glasgow, Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester and Sheffield?
There are a few reasons why I don't want Birmingham to do it. Actually, one reason. They hosted last time the UK hosted the event in 98.
No great animus against Birmingham. You just think they've had their shot.
Exactly.
Okay.
Same with Glasgow. I feel that Glasgow has been having a lot of attention hosting events like, you know, COP21. And you know what? Let's give space to a city. I mean, I've never been to Newcastle. I don't know what to expect. And I like that feeling of not knowing what to expect. It might be horrible, but, you know, I still want to visit. And I think the accent is very charming. Is it what they call the Geordie accent?
It is what they call the Geordie accent, and it is indeed charming.
Very cute.
And, in fact, so is Newcastle. It's a nice city.
And friendly locals, I think, is, you know, one
terrifyingly
part...
Terrifyingly friendly locals,
no,
it's in
one
fact,
part of
my
the
experience.
You know, it's one part of the mix that makes a great Eurovision host city, in my opinion.
Sophie, in an attempt to generate some controversy here, do you have a different opinion?
Well, I do. And one thing I wanted to go back to just quickly was the list that this shortlist was made from and some of the casualties on there. Obviously, London and some more kind of obvious choices, but like Brighton. But one of the ones that I really enjoyed seeing on there and I would have loved to see on this shortlist was Darlington.
Niche.
And I just love the idea of a market town hosting Eurovision. I feel like that would have been great, and maybe they could have just let that slip in and see what happened.
I mean, there is a precedent for that sort of, isn't there, Fernando? Because there was a period, wasn't there, during that interregnum where the Republic of Ireland hosted it every year for what seemed like decades. They basically did hold it in a paddock somewhere, didn't they, at one point?
I mean, yes.
That I'm saying Darlington is a paddock.
But it's a good tradition, I think, that the Eurovision Song Contest have. They tend not to go to the main cities, although in the last decade they kind of went to the capitals like Vienna, Stockholm. But remember, even Harrogate had won Eurovision.
Who can forget?
A long time ago, of course, the iconic city of Harrogate. So, I mean, look at this year, it was Turin. I mean, it's a lovely, a beautiful Italian city, but it's definitely not Rome or Milano, you know. So they Dusseldorf as well hosted for Germany. So it's not a new thing that they try to explore other cities. And there's another reasons for example, why I think London didn't make the top seven. If you want to host, you basically have to reserve an arena for about a month. And basically, London will probably need a new arena because I think, let's say, O2 Arena, whatever. I mean, it's almost not very practical to have it booked just for Eurovision as well for a month. But it's just me guessing the reasons why perhaps London is not in the top seven.
See, I think there's three cities on this list that cannot be allowed to have it.
Which ones?
They are Leeds, Liverpool and Manchester. And the reasons for that, I have nothing in particular against those three cities individually. I wish to make perfectly clear. It's just that Leeds and Manchester hate each other. Liverpool and Manchester hate each other. Probably Manchester. Basically, they all hate each other. And if one of those three gets it, then the other two are just... We're never going to hear the end of it from the other two. If Glasgow gets it, we would probably not hear the end of it from Edinburgh for a bit. But Edinburgh is the sort of city that probably wouldn't descend or wouldn't wish to be seen to be descending to complaining about not getting Eurovision because they would just say our festival's better anyway.
I
think Glasgow's a safe bet.
I was happy that actually Edinburgh was not there. I mean, beautiful city, but extremely expensive. Can you imagine with an Eurovision in town? I mean, I feel sometimes more expensive than London for a reason, you know? It's very... So who knows?
I think Edinburgh maybe takes itself a little bit too seriously for Eurovision. Somewhere
well, exactly.
like Glasgow's got a little bit more of a sense of humour.
Sophie, did you, when you were sort of making Darlington's case there, you kind of avoided the question of which of these seven you would pick? See, I would also, I have to say, go for Newcastle because I think it's a really interesting town. It's really good fun. It's beautiful. It's a really, really handsome city. It looks, in fact, a little bit like Glasgow. I don't think Charles Rennie Mackintosh built nearly as, or indeed any of Newcastle, but it's got that same sort of vibe to it. And it also, heartwarmingly for this Australian, has a sort of little transistorised miniature version of the Sydney Harbour Bridge across the Tyne as you come in by train.
Well, I think I'm going to go with the Scottish side of me and say I would vote for Glasgow. One thing as well that we should obviously remember is that this is about hosting the event for Ukraine. And because of that, I think it's kind of important to choose somewhere that's got a really good relationship with welcoming refugees and immigrants. Scotland has an amazing reputation for that. And I think Glasgow, therefore, is a pretty good winner.
That is an absolutely excellent point. And this does bring us to something, Fernando, that the organisers are surely going to consider. For all that the UK is the host, it's not really going to be the UK's event, is it? They surely have to be thinking about how can we put Ukraine out in front of this as much as we possibly can.
Absolutely, because I think people sometimes they are getting a little bit confused. I think it will be hosted, of course, here in the UK, but I have a feeling the whole show will be very, very Ukrainian. Now, they might add a few elements of the UK just to say, they decided to host it here.
But there surely has to be, for example, hosted by Ukrainians,
yes,
doesn't it?
A Ukrainian celebrity or I'm pretty sure that this is what's going to happen. And I was actually having a look at the list as well. I mean, I might be wrong with the numbers, but Manchester here, apparently they have the largest Ukrainian community from the top seven. I might be wrong, so please, no hate email there. But I think that could be one of the things that could go in favour of Manchester there as well.
Well, we will doubtless be keeping up to date with this story as they winnow that list down. Actually, Fernando, what is the process? Are they just going to pluck one from that, or are they going to draw this out for months, little by little, bit by bit, a bit like the Conservative Leadership Contest?
It will be almost like the Conservative Leadership Contest, but I think there will be a second round and then the final stage. And I believe by late autumn, we should know what is the winning city. And then in a few weeks, I mean, please buy the tickets as fast as you can. Because
and how do they settle this? Do they end up coming down to two cities and they just call the citizens of both cities out for a massive punch-up in a field somewhere? Because I think Leeds, Liverpool and Manchester especially would be all aboard for that.
I'm afraid it's all behind the scenes. We're never going to know the answer. I guess it'll be in the end, I mean, who has the better arena as well?
Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sophie Monaghan Coombs, thank you both for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. And finally on today's show, Copenhagen Fashion Week has been occurring this week. And our fashion editor, Natalie Theodosi, has just returned. And she joins me now in the studio. That is accurate, isn't it? You have literally just got back from Copenhagen.
I have literally just landed 2 hours ago, but I'm very happy to be here chatting to you about your favorite subject, fashion.
Well, we both know that's not true, but let's just go with it anyway. First of all, that's a nice setting, Copenhagen at this time of year. What use does Fashion Week make of the city?
Well, Copenhagen Fashion Week, especially, the organizers there really make an effort to make the most of their city. And most of the show venues, they use city landmarks. So there you'll find shows that take place in public squares, by the harbor, on a bridge. One brand closed off a bridge to host its show there for its 20th anniversary celebrations. So you really get to sightsee and enjoy the city. And it also means that passersby and people who are not fashion professionals and invited to this show can also join along, and it makes fashion more democratic, which is really important, I think.
So it's a properly big deal. It takes over the city. It's not like you could go to Copenhagen and not notice it was happening.
No, I think it's quite noticeable. And you'll see taxi drivers, people on the streets, they notice the fashion crowds. They can tell that something's going on. And whenever there is a public show and they see the commotion and join along and they can watch.
Well, we'll talk a bit more shortly about what people were actually wearing. But first of all, you did interview the CEO of Copenhagen Fashion Week, who has been trying to take it in a bit of a different direction these last few years. Let's have a listen.
I started at Copenhagen Fashion Week 3.5 years ago. I thought it was important to broaden up what Fashion Week is all about, to not only be centered on the newest trends, not to say that we should not celebrate creativity, craftsmanship, and, you know, the amazingly talented designers. That is also what, obviously, a fashion week and a fashion industry is all about. But what I found lacking a little bit was reflections on and perspectives on the society around us. That is also why we went so hard into sustainability and went out with a very ambitious sustainability strategy and an action plan. But that's also one of the thoughts behind our talks, that we know we have a big platform. As I mentioned in the beginning, it's attended by a lot of people physically, but it's also a digital platform now. And when you have a big voice, I find that you have a moral obligation also to use that voice. Instead of only talking about trends, I also think it's important that we broaden up the conversation and talk about issues that we are faced with in our everyday life, and issues that are urgently and currently affecting society around us, such as sustainability, social justice, and so forth.
Those subjects she mentions, Natalie, and the idea of incorporating them into Fashion Week, in practical terms, how did those things end up being manifested in the event?
So during Copenhagen Fashion Week, there is a series of talks that the CEO, Cecilia Thornsmark, has introduced the past 2 years now. So alongside with fashion shows, you can also join along panel talks and discussions that dissect these issues that the fashion industry and society in general is facing. So the different panelists from different parts of the industries will get together and they will discuss fashion's waste issues and how do we become more sustainable, how do we become more inclusive, social justice, working conditions in the factories and the manufacturing side of the business. So what she has been trying to do is use the platform for conversation as much as the fan side, which is the fashion shows and the trends and the new clothing that we see on the catwalks.
Which we will get to. But before we do that, we have another clip from the CEO. You also asked her about whether she was receiving any support in her efforts to become more sustainable from Denmark's government.
I think we are gaining a little bit. We have gained a little bit more support recently for the transition of the industry. But it is really lagging behind, unfortunately. And it's one of the big struggles in our industry to gain the proper support and respect from government. Fashion here is perceived as, it is of course perceived as an important export sector. Culturally, it doesn't rank high. We have the architects and the art and the films that rank higher. So, and I think we've been talking so much about the problems, the challenges in the fashion industry for a long time. And it seems to be the story that government press wants to stick to here, instead of seeing the potential to go in and support and actually change how the industry is operating. But that's another, we can talk about that another day, but that is one of the things that we're struggling with the most.
Well, let's talk a bit about the fashion that was actually on display. Had I been myself at Copenhagen Fashion Week, for example, and it's an outrage that Monocle did not send me, what would I have learned about what I will be wearing this autumn?
Well, Andrew, this season especially, there was a big push on menswear brands, so you would have been very excited to be at Copenhagen Fashion Week with me. A lot of menswear designers were back on the catwalk from Oslo, from Stockholm, Copenhagen natives as well. And what they were showing was this mix of utility and sportswear, and the Scandinavians love being outdoors, so that's a big part of their lives. And they would mix that with loose tailoring and some more polished clothing. And they're really thinking about just simple everyday garments that can take them from, I don't know, riding their bikes in the city to going to work to then dipping in the river at the end of the day. So they want to keep things practical. But the other thing that was really interesting in these collections was that they're investing a lot in material innovation. So they showed a lot of interesting new fabrics that are made more responsibly and they're less wasteful. Something that really struck me was a merino wool fabric that's now embroidered with volcanic ash, apparently, and it helps regulate your temperature. There's other...
Does it really, though, or do they just think, this is cool?
I think it does. I think a lot of research goes into these things.
I mean, I'm not saying it isn't cool. It clearly is, but I just wonder if they're troweling on the scientific pertinence as well.
Yeah, I think with these things, it's early stages, and it's a mix of... Some of it might be gimmick, some of it is actually, it stands for what it is, but it's important that they are doing this research and investing in innovation to move things forward.
At the risk of pivoting to stereotype, though, and just picking up on what you were saying about the practical and outdoorsy nature of a lot of what was being paraded on the catwalks, is it generally a thing that people think of Copenhagen Fashion Week and Scandinavian fashion events as the kind of places you go to see the more practical, minimal, rugged stuff, while the fancy frou-frou fipperies are what you get to enjoy in Paris and Milan?
I think that was very much the idea, especially at the beginning when Copenhagen Fashion Week was at its earlier stages. It became known either for outdoorsy, practical clothing, or at some point it was just known for very colorful, over-the-top women's dresses. and it was a very specific look. But now it's been a few years, and the Fashion Week has really established itself and opened up its scope. So there's designers that do lots of different things. There's a whole younger generation that's coming through that does more experimental clothing, that they look at grunge and other subcultures. There's the brands that do the sporty outdoorsy stuff that we spoke about, women's wear brands that do evening wear. So it's a much broader scope now, and it goes to show why all these international buyers and press now have Copenhagen firmly placed into their schedules as an important trip to take twice a year to buy clothes, to discover new brands, and to do business.
Natalie Theodosi, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to all our panellists today, Georgina Godwin, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, and Natalie Theodosi. Also to Henry Rhys Sheridan for his letter from NYC. Today's show was produced by Chris Chermak and researched by Lillian Fawcett and Tamsin Howard. Our sound engineer was Emily Sands, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.